I call the meeting of the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Representative Vang, have you reviewed the minutes for March 11th?
Yes, so moved.
Representative Vang moves the minutes for March 11th, 2026. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Members, we have a full agenda today. I am turning the gavel over to Vice Chair Smith as I have the first bill.
Chair Hansen, when you're ready, feel free to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 4080 to be referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee.
And I believe, Chair Hansen, that you have an A3 author's amendment. Would you like to move that amendment and explain it briefly for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To get the bill in the shape I'd like, the A3 amendment pushes out some of the dates so they're not so aggressive. I think it would be a good addition to the bill. So I'd move the A3 amendment.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, Chair Hansen, it also deletes a couple of words on line 11 of page 1 that takes out just meat and includes all sales. Is that your intention?
Chair Hansen, to the question?
The question was on lines 111. On the original bill, it takes out sales of meat on 1.11, and the answer is correct. That was my intention to take that out.
Okay. Chair Anderson?
Well, it's about more than just meat here then, but yeah, let's go ahead and hear it.
Chair Hansen has moved the A3 to get the bill in the form he would like. All those in favor, please signify, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. Rep. Hansen, to your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 4080, as amended, is a bill that prohibits dominant retailers from obtaining an ownership interest or entering into exclusive contracts with livestock dealers or meatpacking companies. And then it has the enforcement of this section is split between the Department of Agriculture and the Attorney General. That is why the bill would be going to State Government Finance, because it has reference to the Attorney General. It defines a dominant retailer and talks about prohibited ownership and exclusive contracts. It provides for a certification, and again, in the A3 amendment, that pushed the certification, public comment period, and enforcement actions out until 27 and 2028. And that is the bill.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. We have testifiers for the bill. First up is going to be Robert Lopez. Please identify yourself and begin your testimony when you're ready.
Hello. Thank you, Committee Chair and members. My name is Robert Lopez. I am a Deputy Legislative Director for UFCW. I am here to testify in support of House File 4080. This bill would protect labor standards in the meatpacking sector and establish market competition for a more robust meatpacking industry. UFCW Local 663 and 1189 represent nearly 23,000 hardworking men and women that work in grocery retail stores, food process and meatpacking plants, as well as the emerging cannabis industry. These hardworking men and women put food on the table for Minnesota families and are an integral part of America's food supply chain. Vertical integration in the meatpacking sector reduces workers' bargaining power, leads to job loss, destroys small and independent businesses, and makes it harder for workers to form a union in the meatpacking sector. When one company controls multiple parts of a supply chain, manufacturing, distribution, and retail, workers get squeezed in that industry and are left with few, if any, alternatives. This downward pressure weakens union leverage and wage negotiations because labor cannot easily move to a competitor. Vertically integrated firms also exert more power over working conditions. They won't impose uniform policies across the entire supply chain with control over warehousing, logistics, and retail. This gives workers less control and ability to negotiate with these firms over these conditions. Integration often leads to job consolidation and automation. These firms will conduct rounds of efficiency restructuring with logistics automated, warehousing consolidated, and jobs eliminated. This prioritization of cost savings over employment stability will destroy communities that depend on families sustaining union jobs. There is also less opportunity in the market for small and independent businesses. Vertically integrated firms replace contractors, suppliers, and distributors with internal operations. This will eliminate smaller firms or local employers, reducing competition in the market and eliminating diversity in the sector. Large vertically integrated firms make it harder for workers to form unions in the sector. Vertical integration allows centralized management to deploy anti-union strategies across multiple divisions. If workers across a supply chain are not organized simultaneously, the firm can shift work internally to non-union units. Don't be fooled by the notions of efficiency and lower costs for consumers masked as control and domination of a sector. When a dominant retailer integrates, the clock begins on a race to the bottom for workers, consumers, and small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Steve Barthel from the Minnesota Growers Association. When you're ready, please identify yourself for the record and start your testimony. Thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Chair Hansen, Chair Anderson, and members of the committee. My name is Steve Barthel. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Grocers Association. For more than 125 years, the MGA has been proud to serve as the leading voice for Minnesota's food industry. Today, we represent more than 250 member companies operating over 1,300 locations statewide, including food producers, manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 4080, which seeks to prevent already dominant retailers like Walmart and Costco from further expanding their influence over the food industry by restricting their ability to integrate their own meatpacking operations. We recognize that any significant policy change can carry the risk of unintended consequences, and we encourage lawmakers to proceed thoughtfully while continuing to seek input from all stakeholders who would be affected by this proposal. However, we know that there is also great risk in doing nothing. The continued consolidation occurring across nearly every sector of the economy, including the food industry, should be a concern for policymakers and consumers alike. As industries become more consolidated, dominant retailers gain greater leverage to extract concessions from suppliers who have little choice but to comply. These concessions include preferential contract terms, pricing, and strict fulfillment rate requirements, in case you were wondering where all the toilet paper went during the pandemic. To make up for these concessions, suppliers frequently charge higher prices to smaller retailers, placing independent businesses at a significant competitive disadvantage. We have seen this dynamic play out repeatedly in the grocery industry. When a dominant retailer enters a market, they use their scale and pull over suppliers to dramatically undercut competitors, and locally owned stores struggle to compete. Between 1990 and 2015, the United States lost nearly 40% of its independent grocery stores. These closures not only reduce competition, but weaken the economic and social fabric of the communities these local stores had served for generations. Local businesses support your local schools, youth sports teams, community festivals, and civic organizations. They offer first-time jobs and great lifelong careers. And as many communities have experienced, once a small town store closes, it is incredibly difficult to replace. The high startup costs of opening a new store, combined with an average industry profit margin of around 1% to 2%, means it's very unlikely another independent retailer will be able to open a profitable operation. Allowing vertical integration of meat production by already dominant retailers would intensify these disparities in one of the most important product categories in grocery. If independent retailers lose the ability to compete in this space, it will further erode their ability to remain viable. We respectfully encourage the committee and the legislature to move forward thoughtfully with this proposal in a way that protects meat producers, workers, independent retailers, and the communities that rely on them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Leon Platts, who I believe is testifying via Zoom today. Mr. Platts, can you hear us? Mr. Platts, we can't hear you. You may be muted from your side.
How about now? Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Please start over your testimony and identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Hansen and Co-Chair Anderson and committee members. My name is Leon Plates. I'm a livestock crop farmer from southwestern Minnesota, Redwood County. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill, which is an important step to prevent further consolidation in the meat industry. Give you a little bit of my experience. I've been raising cattle for over 50 years. Grew up on a dairy farm, so I started raising Holstein beef. Did that for about 30 years. Initially, when I started feeding these animals, we had, as producers, approximately five separate entities to market to. Over time, as these entities either closed or consolidated, my basis narrowed. Every time a plant closed, the basis got wider. Simply, the basis is the difference of what a producer gets and the Chicago Board of Trade. So each time a plant closed, basis widened. It got to a point, we are down now to basically one producer, or excuse me, one processor that slaughters Holstein meat. Because of that, I got out of the Holstein business. I'm feeding beef cattle now. The same situation exists there. The margins are incredibly thin. The costs are incredibly high. We need competition to allow independent producers to exist. What's happening, I'm trying to get my son to take over my operation. I've got a degree in ag economics and a banking degree. I understand the financial conditions that are going on. It's incredibly difficult for young people to take over these operations because of the enormous fiscal cost of doing it. We need the market out here as a competitive thing to keep us in business. Along with my farm products, I do custom harvesting of livestock feed, primarily to smaller beef operations. We continue to lose, my business keeps losing customers because they can't compete anymore. We need a bill like this to keep competition out here. Vertical integration only makes money for the entity integrating. The producers who supply products and the people who purchase them lose out. I really appreciate the opportunity you've given me to talk here. Any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That is the last pre-sign-up testifier we have. Is there anyone here today who would like to testify that is not signed up? All right. We will move to questions from members. Members, are there any questions? Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Anderson, for the bill. It's interesting, just as a meat producer myself. I'm curious, I think there's a thoughtful way to talk about this, and I'm just trying to phrase it up right, but maybe go down to line 1.18. I'm curious, is there like, maybe this is for someone on staff, but I'm curious about exclusive contracts and a definition of that. What does that look like? I understand the ownership interest, and I can kind of relate to what that means in the bill, but I'm curious about exclusive contracts. Is there a definition already in statute, or is this something that the bill addresses? I haven't read it yet.
Chair Hansen?
I would defer to staff for if there's a statutory reference to exclusive contracts.
Ms. Mullenbeck?
Chair, Representative Burkle, exclusive contracts is explained more in paragraph B on page 2, where any livestock dealer or meat packing company cannot exclusively sell. The contract can't require the livestock dealer or meat packing company to exclusively sell their product to the dominant retailer.
I don't have the whole thing here in the underlying bill. Oh, here we go. 2.1.
Representative Burka, when you're ready.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still, would that mean then that if a producer was just supplying for, let's say, the dominant retailer and no one else, is that's what we're talking about? I'm curious. I'm having a hard time with what an exclusive contract would look like and whether or not that's a fair way to limit someone's ability to enter into the business. How would you see that?
Ms. Mollenbach, do you want to take that question?
I would think about it, Chair and Representative Burkle, I would think of it more as prohibiting a provision in a contract instead of the actual dealer or a meat producer.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, that's the only question I have. I'm as a producer myself, I'm kind of partial to the language as far as ownership goes, seeing big retailers owning businesses like that, such as packing houses and whatnot. But I'm just curious about that relationship and how the Attorney General, how this would be enforced. So I'm struggling with it, but I'll continue. I'm curious to learn more. I don't know where I'm at in it right now, but we can visit more offline. Chair Hansen.
Sure. Chair Hansen, would you like to respond at all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Burkle. You know, this bill has got to go to at least two more committees. I would like to work with you. I'd like to get the bill out today as we're approaching deadline. And if we need to provide some clarity on that, I'm happy to work with you on that, you know, between this and the next stop.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Smith and Chair Henderson. Henderson, I mean, there. I don't know. Maybe we'll just shorten it, combine it all together here. So.
One mega chair.
We'll just have one chair in the committee, Henderson. I'm kind of intrigued by the bill because I agree that I think there's a lot of problems with vertical integration. I think probably the one area that I have a little bit of concern with is, there's probably two areas. One is going to be, how enforcing across state lines. I mean, that isn't our area of jurisdiction, but it's just I don't know how that works or what that looks like. But then on the other side of it, I think really kind of coming into the exclusive contract, I know with, when I was a milk producer, AMPI was the co-op we belonged to, and we had an exclusive contract to them. AMPI could sell their milk to whatever outlets, but for us, that was our co-op, that was who we had to contract through, and I don't think it was an issue with vertical integration at all, but it was. For us, it was that, they counted on a certain amount of milk that we produced, and we knew that they were taking that amount of milk. And I think, if you've got a processor, a meat processor that, contracts into a dominant retailer, and they're going to buy all, their complete supply. I understand that, you can get into the unfavorable contracts, but I think also it would prevent them to, if they've got a good deal and they got a product that they really want, it's going to prevent that. So I definitely agree with the ownership of it. I think there's under subdivision one, the ownership is something that I see as a real, I agree fully with that. The contract, that's where I get into a little bit of probably a sticking point, because I think that, a contract that's negotiated between somebody. When somebody buys, if they get into ownership, then that's a real issue there. But I think there is issues with vertical integration, and I appreciate this. So thank you.
Do you want to respond at all, Chair Anderson?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson. I think, and I've said this before, but I look at building a bill. This is not written in stone, and you can see that with the change that I did with the A3. I think it's, you know, we often hear at the Capitol talk about political power, but we're really talking about market power here and the issue of exclusivity. So if we have the dominant retailer and you have that contract, you have that contract and they hold that power over that contract, and they could end that, and then you're out of luck because there's no more competition. And so what we've seen is this has just happened. I mean, my community in South St. Paul used to be the center of the world on packing houses. And now, you know, there's just one left, and we have to continue to work on that. But we have to try something here. And I'm asking, you know, everyone on this committee, let's try to work on this. It's got to go through a couple stops. Maybe it doesn't make it. But let's keep moving and try to get some definition. I can see where both you and Representative Burkle are coming from on that exclusivity, because it goes both ways. How do we protect the farmer? And then how do we protect the market so there is competition, so that then you're helping the consumer? I think it's very unique for us. We've just had testimony from Farmers Union, grocers, and the workers. We usually don't get all three together. And so I think that shows the importance of the issue, and if we can try to get this, you know, I'd ask for your support to at least move it out and get it to the next committee.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, as I think of the current system that we have of independent producers, independent processors, independent retailers to the customer, each step of the way there's a bit of a check and a balance to the quality of that product. You know, if the processor gets some beef that doesn't look quite right or whatever, they'll say, well, no, I'm not comfortable with that. And each step of the way, that's the other problem that could come, I think, with vertical integration, is that who provides that oversight between steps? I don't know if that's part of your thought process or not. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gander, when you have just one, I mean, there's that power of one and the monopoly that's there, and they can choose whether to, I mean, they're just not that competition, you know, and I think that's where it hurts on quality eventually too. You know, if you've got one that is dominant, and the bill talks about 20 states, you know, if you got a dominant retailer that's got a footprint in 20 states, how does a little mom and pop, how do little mom and pop grocery stores, how do farmers deal with that? Because it forces the more big. It just continues to go larger and larger. And so I think, again, this bill is an attempt to try to deal with that. I'm fully aware of the Commerce Clause, you know, but I think we need to try. And I've just seen over the years when a state tries and other state tries, then maybe there's some federal action. You know, it may take a while, but showing that this is important and that we can move on this and keep working on this. And I, you know, again, commit to you to keep working on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Chair Anderson, I think, is the last question. Closing comments, maybe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Hansen, a couple of things I have issues with. Line 1.14 kind of makes me think of Proposition 12 out of California when we're looking at what somebody may be doing in at least 20 states and then dictating what they can or can't do. I think that's fraught with legal challenges, but that might not be for this committee to determine that. The other thing, on the amendment we adopted on page, or I should say line 10 of page 1, you say they're primarily engaged in the sale of meat, but on with your amendment you add in all of their sales. So let's just say somebody sells a whole bunch of tires and mouthwash and toothpaste, and so we're aggregating all of those things into, you get to the 18 million, and then we're going after meat. So I think judicial might be a good stop for this committee, and I would be okay with that if we can find out from financial folks, fiscal folks, is there a fiscal note with this bill?
Mr. Savory, you want to answer that question?
Chair and members, there is a pending fiscal note on House File 4080. This does have the Attorney General is listed as had enforcement action within it, so hence why the bill would need to go to state gov as the Attorney General relies is underneath the State Government Committee. Additionally, because the committee acted favorably on the author's amendment, we'll have to resubmit the fiscal note to make sure they're doing the analysis on the most accurate and up-to-date language.
Chair Anderson.
That may be a problem. Chair Hansen, we have had a long-standing agreement this session to not move bills out of here that had fiscal notes, pending fiscal notes. Your thoughts on that?
Chair Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, and let me just go back to the first question on the meat. So we kept the primarily engaged in the sale of meat. So it's got to be primarily a meat retailer. Yes, you'd have other retail sales, but at $18 billion. It still is a primarily a meat retailer. On the question, I was hoping we could talk about releasing some of these bills. I know that a number of committees, I'll just go on that I'm on, environment is sending bills to Ways and Means without having the subsequent cut. So I think if we're at the point, this would have to go to State Government Finance for the Attorney General portion, and it would need to go to Judiciary. You are correct. So that's why I said if we could at least move it here. I know there are others. I would like to talk to you about Monday a little bit on what we can do here to maybe keep some bills alive as it moves along.
Chair Anderson?
Yeah, I wish we had talked earlier, but again to Mr. Savory, what can you comment at all about the size of the fiscal note you may be expecting on this?
Mr. Savory?
Chair and members, I'm unsure if the amendment that was adopted will change anything from the Department of Agriculture's perspective on what their analysis might look like. I know from time to time the Attorney General will respond to fiscal notes in the State Government Committee with varying costs based on various levels of enforcement action, or the content of the bill may dictate that. But I'm unsure in terms of what the final number would be.
Okay, Chair Anderson.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And then Chair Hansen, could you comment on the line 1.14? Would that stand up to legal challenges, in your opinion?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know how many lawyers we've got in our committee. and they usually don't take the risk of giving an opinion when they're here. And I know the concerns about Prop 12, but you could also have a dominant retailer that could make that decision, because they have that power of the market. So, you know, if you want independence, I think having this type of bill gives that independence so that they have the competition that would provide for that. And again, saying that clearly with the Interstate Commerce Clause, but I believe this is an attempt to try to do something.
Chair Anderson?
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Yeah, as you say, that would be up to that company's decision to make. And, you know, Chair Hansen, in the spirit of bipartisanship, I'm going to ask our members to let this bill go out of the committee. And being it has a couple other stops, you mentioned the state governed judicial, to make sure that what's done is right and correct and that we aren't overstepping the bounds. So with that, I would support the bill today.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just a final comment. If there is an impact to the Department of Ag, if there's time to revisit the bill here again, would that be, give us your word on that? Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great, thank you, Chair Anderson. Chair Hansen, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to make sure that I got that on the record, yes, Representative Anderson. And then, you know, maybe it can be a Henderson bill in front of the state Government Finance Committee. I'll take getting it out of here. So,
all right.
Appreciate
wonderful.
Your support.
Oh, yep. Thank you, Chair Hansen. He renews his motion that House File 4080, as amended, be referred to the state, re-referred to the State Government Finance and Policy Committee. Sorry?
As amended. Yeah.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those against?
Aye.
The motion does prevail. The bill is on its way. Next up, we have Chair Lee, if you want to head to the table. The actual chair will return.
Representative Lee, would you like to move that House File 3693 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee, I believe you have a DE1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and explain it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to get in the shape that I want. So the DE1 amendment increased the funding allocation for the local food purchasing program to 2.450, and we are looking at taking that from the Green Fertilizers Facilities Program, and so it will be budget neutral.
Representative Lee moves the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the form the authors want. Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 3693 to continue the work that we started last session. As you all remember, last year the federal government cut over $3 million for the popular local food purchasing assistance, or LFPA, program, which provide grants to food shelves and other nonprofits to purchase food directly from farmers. This helps out people who are hungry in our community, and it also helps farmers build their businesses. And so with that, that's why we're bringing this bill forward. I believe, and just connecting with the Farmers Union and whatnot, the amendment as we adopted it provides 1.75, and so just a little bit over half of what was cut from the federal program, around $3 million for the state of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to testifiers before we take questions.
Our first testifier is April Ledoux, Chum Food Shelf. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
April Ledoux. Thank you, Chairman and Committee, for having me today. And thank you to the JRLC. They asked me to testify in favor of HF 3693, Local Food Purchase Assistance. My name is April Ledoux. I'm the director of Chum Food Shelf. That's located in Duluth, Minnesota. Just last year, we did distribute over 572,000 pounds of food. That's also 10,500 people that had came through our food shelf. Within that time, we also had around 2,000 of them were just brand new intakes. So our food shelf is definitely growing. We have programs that go Monday through Friday. We roughly go through around 300 boxes a week that we're serving in the area. The CSA program is a very, very important program that we offer. We are the only food shelf in the North End that actually offers CSA shares to our community. We have 7 farmers, which is 65 total shares that comes out. Roughly, we're spending anywhere from $42,000 to $44,000 just for a season. That brings us fresh collard greens, bok choy, kohlrabi, radishes, squash, et cetera, et cetera. Just to be able to have that to give it to families are so important. And they're coming to our food shelf because they can't afford these. To have that on the table, in their kitchen, in their home, or even just for a homeless person who does want to try to eat right, which is you can't really do with the, with what you get for EBT. People who are receiving EBT cannot afford to eat healthy. Produce is very expensive, and I know it's because I myself was a single mother of three kids. I had three daughters barely getting by and trying to hold a job, picking up sick kids at school, or struggling to pay rent and bills. Trying to find help and to provide more for just my kids was a struggle. So I know that how hard it is to be able to eat healthy and be able to provide is very hard to do. With our CSAs that we buy, just to be able to find other resources, we would be able to get more shares to provide more for more of a community that we have out there. Thank you for having me. I don't have anything else.
Thank you. You did great.
Okay.
Next up, Dan Zimmerly, Minnesota Farmers Union via Zoom. Welcome.
Can everybody hear me all right?
Yes. Proceed. Right. State your name for the record.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Dan Zimmerly. I'm from Waldorf, Minnesota, and with my wife, Laura, we own and operate a produce farm called Cedar Crate Farm. On behalf of Minnesota Farmers Union, I'm glad to share my strongest support of Representative Lee's bill to expand LFPA, House File 3693. Sorry, my notes just disappeared. I'm glad to share why I feel like this program is worth further investment because it helped my farm in a very big way. My farm is just over 3 acres in size, and we're an intensive vegetable farm that sells primarily to the end consumer. Through our local farmers market, a 100-member CSA program, our online farm store, and some wholesale partners. My farm is my full-time job, and I also employ about 6 seasonal workers every season to help us bring in the harvest. In 2024, LFPA helped us get through a very challenging time. We had some of the worst weather we've ever experienced in our 12 years of farming. We received a year's worth of rain from the period May 15 to July 15. And on top of that, we had a devastating hailstorm on June 22nd, 2024 that destroyed our tomato crop. We were in a very tough place. I didn't know if I was going to be able to make payroll. I didn't know if our farm was going to survive that season. And the way that LFPA helped us through that was LFPA was able to buy damaged produce from our farm that wasn't fit for retail sale, but still perfectly good for processing into nutritious meals for our community. And that work was done by South Central Minnesota Food Recovery. So they purchased produce from our farm that was damaged and unfit for retail sale and turned that into nutritious meals that supported folks experiencing food insecurity in our community. Farming's a pretty risky business, as many of you know. One of the risk factors is certainly the weather. And federal crop insurance programs don't offer meaningful coverage for farms like mine. For me, this was one of the first times a government program really came through and sort of kept me going so that I could stay in business, keep my staff on staff, keep them paid, and overall was just a huge benefit to our farm to kind of keep us operating and keep us going in a tough season. On top of that, it was great to know that the produce that we were able to salvage from our farm was going to support a good cause and feed people who needed food in our community. And this is just one example of the types of partnerships that LFPA can create. It's a win-win-win situation for farmers, for people who need help with food, and the local rural economy. I'm glad to see that you're considering increasing funding for LFPA. And I hope that Representative Lee's proposal earns your support. Thank you for your time today and happy to answer any follow-up questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Anyone else in the audience? Mr. Savory, could you just get on the record what amount there is in that particular remnant appropriation?
Sure. Mr. Chair, you'll see in the DE amendment on the last page, or second to last page of the amendment, it's page number 8, lines 8.25. The DE amendment references the previously adopted Agriculture Finance Bill in 2025. As a little bit of a refresher, the Environment Finance Bill in 2023 had an appropriation for $7 million for this green fertilizer appropriation. The expiration date, which was 2032, so the money is available until that, until 2032. And in the agreement that did pass the House and Senate and was adopted by the governor, signed by the governor, reduced that appropriation by $3 million, bringing the appropriation down to $4 million. The department has a small expenditure out of that account. And the last, in my conversation with them, the remaining amount is $3,969,000 remaining of that account, or that appropriation is left.
Members, any questions of Representative Lee or of the testifiers? Representative Gander.
Do we have any, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any anticipated need for those funds in the Green Fertilizer Fund? Are there any pending requests, or do we anticipate anything like that coming down the pike in the foreseeable future? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Savory.
Chair and members, this may be better answered by the department, but I would say that there is nothing restricting the department from using those funds for that purpose at this moment. For example, issuing things like RFPs, entering into grant contracts, et cetera.
Commissioner Bobble? Ready with an answer?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Andrea Bobble. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. To the question, yes, so we do have the remaining amount. We did do two RFPs. I will say when this was passed in 2022, I believe, there was a very different federal landscape in terms of support for projects like what we're trying to accomplish here with green ammonia. However, and so we have not gotten a successful project yet, but I will say that there is significant projects that we feel very confident will come to fruition in the coming years. And so we feel confident that we can get that money spent by the 2032 deadline. And there is a lot of great work happening around the state related to green ammonia that we feel this money could be very supportive of.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm clear, that would be the full roughly $4 million. Okay, thank you.
Representative Lee. Representative Lawrence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. As I read this bill, are there restrictions on food shelves as far as who they purchase or what food they purchase with these dollars? As I read it, it's a grant to food shelves. And if I'm wrong on that, please correct me. But that's what I interpret it as.
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, one second here if I could look at my note. So if you were to look at the language, some of the eligible applicants when we created the bill last year includes, but not limited to, individuals, nonprofit organizations, for-profit businesses, tribal governments, government entities, ag cooperatives, economic development organizations, and educational institutions.
And maybe Commissioner Vauble could come up again just to talk about the process for grants that is set up with the LFPA new name program, if maybe get to get that on the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can also answer that question. So that was the list of eligible applicants. And yes, it is largely a lot of the grantees
that we saw.
You could
state your name for the record, please.
I'm so sorry. Just a little nervous. My name is Kaylee Thornley, and I'm a grant supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And yes, that was the list of eligible applicants, and a lot of the applicants in the federal LFPA program that this was originally based on were food shelves and food access organizations. But yeah, we also had food hubs and farmers markets, clinics and community health organizations, local and tribal governments, economic development organizations as well. Thank you.
Representative Lawrence.
Yeah, just and I appreciate the testimony that came forward. A lot of my questions kind of grew from that, and the support for local food purchasing. And I don't know if anybody has answers to this, but I think it'd be interesting to have a study. The first testifier testified that they sold 500 or gave out whatever 572,000 pounds of food. question came to mind, what was the cost of that per pound, right? What are we investing in a food shelf or a distributor on that cost? And then on the second testifier, when they talked about, you know, some of the food that wasn't made for or didn't make the retail sale was damaged food that was able to go to a food shelf. And my question on the backside of that is how much food actually winds up being disposed of at the end of the day. So what we're financing and what we're giving to food shelves to assist, and then what is the waste factor on the back end? Like I said, I don't know if anybody's here, but I think it'd be an interesting study to see some of that background and follow up with the dollars that we're investing in programs like this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would defer to the department to see if they're tracking that. But, you know, in the establishment of the program, we did ask for a report back. I might not get all the information that you requested, Representative Lawrence, but, for example, we are asking for the report to tell us about the amount of the award for each grantee, the amount each grantee award has been dispersed to, the amount of the awards that has been dispersed, a description of the purposes, and then how successful they were at, you know, providing the mission that they apply for, funding for.
And if the department has any follow-up with it?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is the first time that we are running this program, so we don't have reporting data on that yet. But I know that there were a couple of food rescue projects in the federal program, so it's definitely something we can consider collecting information on. Thank you.
Representative Lawrence.
Sounds good. No further questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where do I start? The program we're tapping into is kind of near and dear to me. And I will start off by saying thanks mainly to your side of the aisle. We did increase funding in last year's budget bill by $500,000, from $700,000 to $1.2 million. So very, very good appropriation in the bill we're currently living with. And I'll just go back a little bit on the green fertilizer piece. A lot of work has been done on that, and originally the governor and the legislature appropriated $7 million, and we all took $3 million of that to do last year's budget. And there is progress being made, and I'll tell you about one of the projects, and there was an article in the Star Trib a couple weeks ago. The project is going to be done, if they can get funding, down in Blue Earth, Minnesota. And a commercial scale anhydrous ammonia production facility. And to me, the highlight of that is the co-op. I think the CFS, Central Farm Service, I think is the name of the co-op that we're trying to work with and a lot of folks are working with. If this comes to fruition, they are going to offer their farmers a 10-year guaranteed price and reliable supply of anhydrous fertilizer. And I think that really is important today as we see a war being waged halfway around the world. The Straits of Hormuz are curtailed, and the price of fertilizer is skyrocketing. And I think this project, which would give that reliability and price and could be duplicated all across the state, is an excellent project. And I really hate to see funding cut for a project like that. And they're going to be trying to get some funding from the renewable development account. But this money here also would be a place to help fund that project. It's about a $6 or $8 million commercial scale project. And being we've worked so long and hard on that to get the funding and maintain the funding or at least maintain part of it, I really hate to see it taken from again. And I totally understand where you're coming from, Representative. And I can't support your bill because it's the green fertilizer thing is just near and dear to me. And I want to see that move forward as a clean way to reduce carbon scores and such for farmers. And I think overall it would be good for all of Minnesota. So thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson. And, you know, in preparation for this, you know, I went to look up on the website, the MDA website for the Green Fertilizer Program, and, you know, one of the first mention of that was how could they pair this state funding with federal dollars, federal tax credit, whatnot. But with the passage of H.R. 1, they're phasing out the federal tax credits for that. And, you know, with the DOGE cuts, some of these loan programs from the Department of Energy that, you know, the MDA referenced on, you know, stacking your dollars to do some of these projects are gone. And so, you know, to your point, if this is a $1 billion project, you know, are we really going to be able to get something done? I know that, you know, in reading after the passage of H.R. 1, some of these big projects, not in Minnesota, across the country, they have stopped because they know that there's no more federal tax credit for them. And so I think that's something for us as a committee to decide, you know, should we continue to put money into a program that may not have the federal offsets to help build these programs and move forward because of, you know, federal actions that there's no more money left over for that. And so I would encourage you all for us to, you know, take a look at, you know, whether we wait for something like that or we move the money forward to feeding, you know, Minnesotans right now. And as you all know, earlier this week was Hunger Day on the Hill, and a lot of our neighbors came to us, and I was glad to see that a lot of the bills that were mentioned have bipartisan authors. You know, some of them are authors by, you know, Representative Gander, Representative Nelson, some of them on both sides of the aisles, and that's going to children and family. And so I think that this is an opportunity for the Ag Committee to really look at, you know, some of the money that we have allocated appropriate out there that hasn't been tapped into, that we put into a program that's very helpful. And just quickly wanted to add that I think you're with the last round of requests for federal funds through the federal program. I think the total was above, you know, $4.9 million in requests. And right now, you know, with 1.4 that's allocated through last biennium, I just don't think that we can meet the needs. And so that's why I'm proposing at least, you know, bringing back at least half of the cuts that were moved from the federal government to really move forward and feed our neighbors right now.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. I hear what you say. Some of these bigger projects that relied on the 45Z, yeah, they've been slow or stopped. But the one I'm talking about would not utilize that, and the cost is in the area of $6 million. So it's not the billion-dollar projects that you're referring to. And a grant of this size would really help that project. And again, I thank you for your words, but again, I just can't support your bill. Thanks.
Are there any other questions? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on, I would like to request a roll call, please, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee renews his motion, or did you have additional comments?
That's all. I really appreciate the discussion, and I urge your member to support the bill as amended. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 3693, as amended, be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Chair Anderson?
Anderson, no.
Anderson, no. Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith, aye. Vice Chair Harder? No. Harder, no. Representative Agbaje? Agbaje, aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
Burkle, no. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Gander?
No.
Gander, no. Representative Godfrey?
Having read the bill before today, aye.
Godfrey, aye. Representative Jacob?
Jacob, no.
Jacob, no. Representative Lawrence?
Representative Lawrence, no.
Lawrence, no. Representative Lee?
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Nelson?
No.
Nelson, no. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Vang, aye.
It is 7-7, and it's tied, so the motion does not prevail. Next up is House File 1857. Representative Smith, Katz. Elective declawing of cats.
I can't just start talking about cats for the next hour?
No. Representative Smith, would you like to move House File 1857 to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee?
So moved, Chair.
Representative Smith, to the bill.
Hi there, members and Chair. Thank you for listening to this bill. I want to first talk about that motion of moving it to Judiciary, and I will be open to you that I do intend to try to pass this bill as a standalone. One of the reasons is the feedback I've gotten from members of this committee. Last year, a version of this bill was part of our agricultural omnibus bill, but it was stripped out of concerns that it might be a slippery slope towards some other things in the area of the Board of Animal Control, like livestock dehorning. And so I want to say very, very clearly that this bill does not have any interest in this, and truly my focus is only on stopping the suffering of cats based on this one procedure and wanting it to be outlawed in our state. I heard those concerns and want to respect them, which is why I'm trying to move this as a standalone so it's not part of our agricultural discussions. So clearly the legislative intent of this bill, it's only focused on prohibiting elective cat procedures, not on animal or livestock regulation or any of the scope of the Board of Animal Health. Now to the bill itself with that long preamble. The research and science is clear that elective cat decline is harmful to cats. It can cause chronic and acute pain, long-term musculoskeletal change, and increased aggression and biting, along with a host of other possible side effects. However, this bill still gives veterinarians the discretion to use a declaw procedure in the instance that it's medically necessary for the feline patient. This bill doesn't limit a vet's scope of medical practice. It simply outlaws a harmful practice that good vets aren't doing in the state of Minnesota right now. I'll leave Dr. Gaskin to talk about the science more generally, but there is a growing global agreement that this is not an acceptable practice. Elective cat decline is outlawed in 6 states and Washington, D.C., as well as several Canadian provinces. It's outlawed in the European Union, including the United Kingdom, in Australia, Brazil, Israel, and many other nations. Veterinarian schools, for the most part, don't even teach this procedure anymore. Policy positions against elective cat decline is published by the following organizations: the American Animal Hospital Association, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association, the American Association of Feline Practitioners, the International Society of Feline Medicine and International Cat Care, the Pet Professional Guild, and the National Animal Care and Control Association. The National Veterinary Associates, which operates 1,400 clinics, including approximately 10 here in Minnesota, have stopped providing decline surgeries as of February 1st of 2025, joining many other large veterinary providers. In their decision, the NVA said, and I quote, "As a company committed to evidence-based research, evidence-based medicine, the research has made it clear that elective decline creates risks of chronic pain, behavioral issues, and mobility problems. With mounting evidence of long-term harm to feline patients, we determined this is the right step forward for modern, compassionate medicine and animal welfare," end quote. Last year, the American Animal Hospital Association, which accredits veterinary hospitals based on high-quality standards of practice, revised accreditation guidelines and now requires hospitals to forego decline cats for non-medical reasons in order to maintain accreditation. There's a widespread agreement that this procedure is not good for cats, not good for cat owners, and in Minnesota, we love our pets, and we should be part of the growing consensus around this issue. I'll close with a personal story, because I also want to make sure that this bill is not presented in any sort of judgmental space. I grew up in a family that had several family cats. One of them was named Sugar. She was a beautiful white cat, and when one of my sisters was born, out of an abundance of caution and talking with a vet, my parents made the hard decision to declaw Sugar. And she did change quite a bit, and unfortunately, died a couple years later, she was changed. She was different. And I mention that story just to say that many cat parents or families have made this decision to declaw cats based on information they've gotten from vets, or vets have given best practice. This is a relatively new procedure from 1952. And this is not a judgment on those cases. This is simply a fact that we have new evidence. We have new research that shows how harmful this is to cats, and so we should put a stop to this practice. So thank you, members of the committee, for listening to this and hopefully allowing me to bring this to the Judiciary Committee.
And we have several testifiers. So first up, Ronald W. Gaskin, Main Street Veterinary Service. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ron Gaskin, owner and operator of Main Street Veterinary Service. And in full disclosure, I am Minnesota Paw Project Director. I'm here in support of House File 1857. I've been a veterinarian for 42 years. I have seen firsthand the functional damage caused by decoying cats. Decoying modifies how cats walk and forces them to walk directly on their amputated toes. The resulting pain and redistribution of weight increases the chance of hip arthritis and lower back pain. That's documented by evidence. When bone fragments are left behind, which is a frequent post-surgery finding, the pain is intensified. Ongoing pain can trigger aggressive behavior, elimination outside of the litter box, and biting. Since 1951, this surgery has been done in ignorance of its anatomy and long-term effects. The phalangectomy surgery, I'm not going to be euphemistic here and call it a declaw because it's a phalangectomy. They take off the whole tip of the finger. It's a phalangectomy. Surgery method has evolved and pain control has evolved, but paw anatomy is the same. About 33% of declawed cats will manifest unwanted side effects in their lifetime. Veterinarians are not checking declawed paws for problems during physical exams. By swearing the AVMA's veterinarian's oath, veterinarians declare that they will prevent and relieve animal suffering. Performing a painful elective procedure that provides no medical benefit to the cat for the convenience of an owner inflicts suffering rather than preventing it and therefore violates the veterinarian's oath. The Center for Disease Control also does not advocate for decline of cats, even if they live with immunocompromised owners. The CDC realizes the declawed cat bite is far more dangerous than a cat scratch. Cats' claws can be trimmed regularly. The University of Minnesota no longer teaches declaw surgery. Scratching is a normal behavior for cats. The new veterinarian has a toolbox of behavioral modification and redirection techniques to prevent unwanted scratching behavior. A cat's claws can be trimmed and are coated with a plastic cover, especially as young kittens. They're still learning the rules, just like our kids. And you can cover these claws temporarily and redirect them to appropriate scratching surfaces. Just basically identify whether they're vertical or horizontal scratchers. What's their preference? Educating cat owners is key. The elective decline of cats is unnecessary. It's cruel. And with your insight and wisdom, it should be banned and show the enlightenment of the state of Minnesota towards our cat companions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee, for your time to present today.
We'll go through all the testifiers. Dr. Peter Memon, Minnesota Veterinary Association. Welcome to the committee. And state your name for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my name is Rob Memon. Just to correct the record on Peter, it's Robert Memon. I'm a resident and a practice owner in Minnetonka, Minnesota. We're a small animal general practice that provides general medical surgical care for cats on a daily basis. I'm also the most immediate past president of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, which I'm here representing today. And so I appreciate the time and the opportunity to share our association's stance on this issue. I'd like to start with reading our MVMA policy on elective declawing and then share some facts that some of which overlap with what's already been presented and then our position on the proposed ban. So first, our policy statement. The MVMA recommends that elective declawing of cats be strongly discouraged unless the procedure is medically necessary as determined by the attending veterinarian. The elective declawing of cats provides no animal health benefits and is strongly associated with negative animal health and welfare outcomes. Veterinarians should educate their clients about normal cat behavior, details of how the procedure is performed, health risks of the procedure, and long-term negative outcomes, and of course, alternative management options. Now, one thing I think is important to note, the language you use in our policy, such as we strongly discourage, unless medically necessary, if you look at the American Animal Hospital Association or the AVMA's positions, you'll find very similar language, not necessarily prohibiting language, but strongly discouraging type of language. So I think we're very consistent with what some of these national organizations are recommending and their views on this issue. So some facts to consider with this context. As mentioned before, Minnesota's Veterinary Medical School is no longer teaching this procedure as part of its training, and a decreasing number of veterinary clinics are offering to perform this procedure entirely. Veterinarians are trained to distinguish between medical and behavioral conditions and provide appropriate client education and counseling. Comprehensive client education commonly changes an owner's desire to proceed with a procedure in the first place. Veterinarians are committed to informed consent and thorough discussion alternatives, regardless of whether or not they elect to perform this procedure. And they may consider claw removal in limited case-specific situations that involve factors beyond a medical diagnosis for the cat. So examples being situations where behavioral modification strategies to address destructive scratching are ineffective. Owners who are elderly, disabled, and may have special needs. Owners who are immune compromised and are more susceptible to infection or illness as a result of a scratch. We also believe current surgical techniques and modern anesthetic and pain medications have greatly reduced the pain and discomfort and negative outcomes associated with the procedure. And for some households, unmanaged behavioral concerns or concerns about human health might contribute to decisions involving relinquishment or even euthanasia. And so as veterinarians, our aim is to provide options that support animal welfare while also taking into effect we need to address these circumstances to reduce the rates of relinquishment or certainly euthanasia. So as an association, our stance is, regardless of personal feelings about the procedure, even amongst our members, the decision to perform a treatment or therapy should be made on a case-by-case basis between a veterinarian and a pet owner. So with that in mind, when we look at the proposed bill in House File 1857, it does bring up some serious concerns that would cause us to oppose it. First and foremost, it removes the veterinarian's and the client's right to choose whether to perform a surgical procedure. We believe it's fundamentally unnecessary because the veterinary medical profession has appropriately regulated itself, moving away from this procedure over the years, and it continues to do so in a thoughtful and compassionate manner. We don't think it considers the legitimate medical conditions of the animal owner when banning the procedure for reasons other than the therapeutic need of the cat. And then finally, we believe it sets a dangerous precedent in legislating what surgical procedures a veterinarian may perform in general. So I appreciate you guys hearing our thoughts as an association, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next up, Megan Hamilton, Basil's Cradle.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Megan Hamilton, and I'm the founder of Basil's Cradle, a 501c3 nonprofit sanctuary for special needs cats. I'm here today to urge you to make sure that HF1857 passes and that the penalties are not removed. If there are no consequences, such a prohibition is pointless. Cats will continue to suffer, and nothing will have changed. That would counteract the goal of this bill, whose objective it is to stop elective decline. Declawing has no medical benefit to cats and causes cats undeserved, unnecessary pain and suffering, not to mention abandonment when the all too common unwanted behaviors such as biting and inappropriate elimination eventually occur. My experience regarding declawed cats and the cruelty involved in this procedure spans many decades. I'm 66 years old. I've been rescuing cats for the past 48 years. Many of these cats were declawed and then abandoned. I have and continue to witness the damage that amputating cats' toes causes. I and many other rescues help those we can, but we can't save them all. And the declawed cats we do save often stay in rescue and are never adopted. Oh, due to the behavioral issues and extreme costs that we work so hard to manage. These cats were discarded and left either on the streets or abandoned at animal control or shelters like damaged goods. The majority of them are on lifelong medication to manage the irreversible pain they experience and or behavior drugs such as Prozac to mitigate the resulting unwanted behaviors and psychological damage that they really truly do suffer. Many veterinarians who still practice declawing justify it by claiming that declawing will keep cats in their homes and they won't be euthanized for unwanted behaviors. This is an easily disproved myth. Many declawed cats end up abandoned precisely because their owners do not want to deal with their behavioral issues after declawing. Many lose their lives in shelters when they are deemed unadoptable due to declawed-related behaviors such as biting, not using litter box, and instead urinating on carpets, beds, and furniture. Those cats that end up in rescue generally stay in rescue due to behavior and physical issues that require psychiatric medication and very expensive pain medication in many cases. And just to give you an example, I just did the math. I have two declawed cats right now that get buprenorphine shots. $150 for a 10-vial package. Over the course of a year, that cost is $2,735 and change per cat, not including the syringes. So this puts an extraordinary financial and emotional burden on those of us in rescue, too. It's not just the cats. Many of these cats are not adoptable, and sanctuaries like mine give them the forever home they should have had. The expenses continue for the rest of the cats' lives, but the much-needed donations that are few and far between barely make a dent in long-term expenses. This takes a great financial and emotional toll on us. Sorry. Amputating cats' toes for the convenience of owners is callous, cruel, and is banned in the majority of countries in this world, as was explained before. This is Minnesota, and we have shown how strong and capable we are. If all these other countries have so much success in keeping their furniture intact and maintaining much lower surrender rates in their shelters, surely we can meet the moment and do the same here. I'm asking you to ensure that HF1857 passes and goes forward with penalties intact. And as an aside, on the handout, on the website, I put in a PDF that has the profiles of a couple cats that have come through my shelter. And you can see their stories. They're all different. And every one of them is terrible. But if you can look and take a chance to see the color photos, this is Fergus, and I know it's hard for you to see him. He was 15 years old, declawed. His family left him outside, and when he was found by animal control after being severely attacked by a dog who he couldn't defend himself from because he had no claws, they said, no, we don't want him. Fortunately, I heard about him. I went and got him, and even though he didn't have a long life, he lived his best life. So I thank you for hearing me out. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer any, and I appreciate your time here today. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Anyone else in the audience? Questions from members? I have Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Smith, for bringing this bill. It's not a question, it's just a comment. And I do apologize, because we have a senior cat who was declawed by a previous owner. And Mr. Gaskin, the symptoms that you talked about, we're seeing in her now. And it's very difficult to watch her get pushed around by her sisters without having a means to defend herself. So I'm going to support this bill. Apologies, members, for getting emotional, but it's tough. Thank you.
Testifier.
I'm very sorry to hear about your cat and your family companion. I'm actually shooting myself in the foot because right now I hold practically the monopoly on the salvage surgery that might help relieve your cat. That's income for my clinic that I'm trying to get rid of, actually. there are new drugs out that you can discuss with your veterinarian, and the plethora of new drugs that have come out for pain control and for orthopedic issues has been amazing the last 3 years. Just throwing that, there's hope. Thank you.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. And Representative Smith, thank you for coming and talking with me about the bill. I appreciate that very much. And as we talked about the bill, I believe I had mentioned that a veterinarian in my area, you know, questioned the bill because she had said that this is rarely done. It's sort of like a last resort, as we have heard. And I, too, have had cats in the past. And the cat that I had, the cat's name was Mercedes, because I wish I could afford a Mercedes. But she, too, was declawed, and that wasn't because I wanted the cat declawed, but it was because I was a renter, right? And the landlord was the one that said if you wanted to have a cat, it must be declawed. But I don't recall my cat ever having any problems after having that done. And this hearing sort of makes me a little squeamish, because when my cat was declawed, I was actually in the room when it was done. So I can tell you that it's not for people to watch, and hats off to the veterinarians for all the work that they do. But in the end, I do believe that I'm going to agree with the veterinarian, I forget the person's name, that this is a case-by-case basis. And if someone wants to do this to their cat, I mean, while I wouldn't do it, should I be the one to stand in their way? It's really between the owner of the pet and the veterinarian to, you know, to go through all the pros and the cons. And from the veterinarian that I know, she had said that before that this is ever taken into consideration, that they go through all these steps to do to avoid having a cat declawed. So I'm going to go, it's a case-by-case basis, and I don't want to be in between a pet owner and the veterinarian. So I apologize, but I'm not going to support the bill at this time. But thank you.
Representative Smith.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Vice Chair Harder. I do appreciate our conversation. Maybe I'll give one more shot trying to convince you. I will say I want to make clear that on lines 1.12 through 1.16, there's a specific allowance of this to be done to address an existing or recurring infection, disease, injury, or abnormal condition in the claws, nail bed, or toe bone that jeopardizes the cat's health. So veterinarians, if they see this as necessary in their opinion, can still do this procedure under this bill if it passed. The other thing I would say, and maybe responding specifically to a previous testifier talking about how this is decreasing, that was true in the 90s. There's actually a chart here if you want to see. It went down quite drastically in the year 2000 to about 20% of all cats being declawed, and has actually stayed pretty static since the year 2000, and in fact has ticked up gradually in the preceding years.
As I said, in that time, several states have noticed this not change, and that's why they have made the change, as have other nations. And maybe two other things I would say is, one is, I'm very sorry to hear about Mercedes, but I'm glad that she had none of the negative impacts. In 2024, we passed a bill now that landlords can no longer require Minnesotans to declaw their cats. So we're starting to recognize as a government, generally in other areas, this is important. And I think we should do it now here just more broadly. The only other thing I would say is, I think there is a line that all of us would have when we talk about between a veteran and an animal owner, where there is something that is too cruel for an owner to be able to say, please do this to my animal. And so I think the question is, based on the research, is this one of those things that we say, no matter if people think they want to do it, they should not be able to do it? And the research, I think, is just really, really clear on, even if people don't realize it, they just think they don't want scratches on the carpet, or they're concerned about their new child, it's really harmful to cats, and this is the way that we can stop folks from doing this. Thank you.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. No, I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
I think we have a testifier wanting to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to
respond. If you can, if you could sit and then introduce yourself again.
I'd just like to respond to the last comment about the rates of declaws not coming down over the over recent decades. The Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association performed a survey of our membership last year and this year. We have over 2,000 members. Approximately two-thirds of our Minnesota veterinarians are in our membership. And I know it's hard to see from here, but this is a graph of when veterinarians in our state, our members, stopped performing elective declaws, either personally or their clinic stopped offering it. 2010 is here. You can see a huge increase in the number of our veterinarians no longer performing the procedure over the last 15 or so years. So an encouraging trend. I have more statistics on those numbers, but in general, as a summary, I would say currently about 30% of our veterinarians that are still involved in practice where that would be an option or are offering declaws, 70% are not. But there's a huge discrepancy in the number of veterinarians who are 2008 graduates and younger or newer, no longer performing the procedure, versus veterinarians that graduated before that. So we're seeing a definite trend with our Minnesota veterinarians in no longer offering or strongly discouraging the procedure. I don't know how that applies to some of our national numbers, but I think this is really important considering these are the people who this bill would affect. And we're seeing the type of change we're looking for through educating veterinary professionals and educating the general public and cat owners. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Gaskin, you looked like you wanted to comment earlier, but if I missed you, I apologize.
No one's asked the question, what about the other 66% that don't show any clinical signs? We have a sentient, intelligent creature here. We've removed part of what they are, and their intelligence dictates that they conduct their own physical therapy. These cats that don't manifest the contracture that I'm talking about with the 33% that start in a painful manifestation of inappropriate elimination or biting or aggression, they actually stretch out their toes and they keep the muscles from cramping. And so they're not walking on their toes. And that 66% can get along just fine and look clinically normal and act clinically normal. It's that 33% over the 18 years of research that I came to that number from the number of declaws that weren't affected and what were they doing different. That's not in the paper. But they can manage it with their own physical therapy. But then some cats that have a lower pain tolerance or they're cramped up or contracted so much because of the rediscovery of the vinculum by Dr. Clarkston in the paper, they contract and they're painful. And that can happen anytime from 1 year to 10 years after the surgery. It needs to be recognized. An intervention needs to be done because typically the scenario I see, inappropriate elimination and a declawed cat. First thing we do is we run a urinalysis. Urinalysis is clean as a whistle. So there's no urinary tract inflammation going on causing inappropriate elimination. Then we try the standard 30-day therapy of fluoxetine or Prozac as an anti-anxiolytic. And that doesn't work. And then the owners of this declawed cat that wanted the quick fix for scratching decide, well, we've tried everything that we can on this cat, and that cat's ghosted from the clinic, undiagnosed for the problems associated with the declaw that happened maybe years previously. We need to know how to recognize that and do appropriate intervention. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson, and then I was going to go to Representative Anderson to close. Representative Loris, Representative Nelson, and then to Anderson.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hansen. And I'm not sure if this is for the author or Dr. Menon, but I'm looking at line 1.12, the section D, you know, the procedure solely for therapeutic services and or purposes. And just wondering what latitude do you have, you know, how do you interpret that? And I think some of it is already, I think the education around this is, you know, that it's a practice that's going away in a lot of ways, if I'm understanding from the veterinarian. But I'm wondering, you know, as a veterinarian that, you know, if somebody is really saying, all right, this is, you know, for what area would you look at if this is a therapeutic, what latitude does that give? Or, I mean, and then looking also at, you know, the penalty side of it, you know, it's like I would hate to have a veterinarian perform one of these, you know, under the belief that is a therapeutic purpose and then come back and get fined for it because you didn't cross your T's and dot your I's. And so I don't know if that's a clear question or not, but maybe to the author first.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I think that's a good question. So one of the examples that was brought up a lot over this is if there's a tumor in that area of the paw needs to be removed. There's a damage to the paw that got run over by a car, and there's a particular thing that can be done. So there's a lot of latitudes. I'm sure we have two veterinarians here, so I'm sure they could go over sort of a laundry list of things. The nice thing about – I shouldn't say nice. I don't really know how to state this. The positive way of the civil penalties, of course, is that they are – done through the board, which has veterinarian experts on it to go through each individual case, look at the law, and see if it has been violated. And I will say that this gives me a moment to talk about the civil penalties because that's been some discussion, especially in the Senate, where there was some discussion about the actual civil penalties. In our law, generally, we're given three reasons for civil penalties to be given. One is to strip the economic advantage of violating some status. The standard cost for a declaw nationwide is about $1,000 with a range of $500 to $1,500. So that's why that first violation is only $500. Hopefully, if maybe unknowingly or accidentally they're caught, really the fine is only the amount that is the cost of the actual procedure, potentially less. And then, of course, it increases as you do more violations. The other two reasons are to discourage future misconduct, which of course I think we all want to do, even those testifying against this bill want to discourage this practice. And the third is to reimburse the board for investigation for just this purpose so that it's not in the courts. It's a board of experts of this medical expertise that could do this. So I find this to be appropriate for this particular procedure, and we worked on this language to give a wide amount of flexibility for veterinarians who think it is necessary in this particular case to perform the procedure.
Representative Nelson. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. I like the advice of Dr. Memon that consultation with the pet owner and looking at all aspects of the case and being able to use your judgment along with the pet owner. I don't think a ban is necessary as long as it's a declining practice and the two work together to do what's best for the cat. So members, vote your conscience.
Yes, thank you for listening to this bill. I feel very passionate about it, and thank you for members of the committee who have shown passion both in committee and outside for talking with me about this. I really do appreciate it. A couple things that I just want to say again to reiterate for the record, especially because I really do appreciate the Minnesota Veterinary Association. I served on health a long time. Professional associations are very protective of their scope of practice, and I absolutely understand that. But also it does – there are times where we as a legislature do have to step in, whether it's between different associations or for particular times where we represent our people. And I want to talk about, again, the most common things brought before this bill as I've been talking to Minnesotans and other associations. The first is safety of children and vulnerable family members, the elderly. Honestly, declawing cats make them more dangerous, which is why the CDC, as was mentioned, does not recommend this. Neither does the Infectious Disease Society of America, because bites are much more dangerous for those who are potentially immune compromised, who are elderly, than trimming their nails or other options for cats. There was also a reference of potentially increasing pet surrenders or increasing euthanasia. That has no peer-reviewed data to support it. In fact, there's peer-reviewed data to refute it. In British Columbia, which is one of the provinces in Canada that has this outlawed, they did a study for just this reason in the 3 years prior to when a ban was passed and the 3 years after the ban was passed. And there was no change both in the euthanasia or in the surrendering rate of cats from previously. That matches with data in our country in cities like Los Angeles that have also banned this practice. And, you know, finally on sort of the government overreach in veterinary care, simply to say, as was mentioned here, 30% of veterinarians in Minnesota still do perform declaw surgeries, which is a large amount of vets. And that also means other vets that are not offering these services if they refuse the service, they might not just lose that potential client because they refuse that particular service the client wants or potentially telling them something they don't want, but also that cat is still going to potentially get declawed elsewhere. We have veterinarian students who are graduating not knowing about this procedure and feeling very negatively about this procedure. We've talked to some of them that now work in clinics that offer this and feel incredibly morally dubious, to say the least, about this and are struggling with burnout just because of things like this being allowable. I think it is our duty as representatives to push this through. So I do truly almost beg you that we can send this through to judiciary. Let's alleviate cat suffering in Minnesota. Thank you, colleagues. Aye.
Been called for. I will test the division by a show of hands. All those in favor, raise their hands. All those opposed, raise their hands. Seven, seven, the motion is tied. The motion does not prevail. Next up, we have one more bill.
All right. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 4350 be referred to the General Register.
And Chair Hansen, I do believe, again, you have a A1 author's amendment. Could you move that and explain it to us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like. And this is the bill that was on the calendar for Monday, and with Monday's committee being lost in the snowstorm, I was chief author of it. It was a Department of Natural Resources bill that affects Department of Agriculture statutes. The history on it, about 10 or 15 years ago, I authored the original bill on viral hemorrhagic septicemia, which was a fish disease at the time. There are more fish diseases now. Since the bill was posted last week, I have had no comment from anyone relating to the bill except the Department of Natural Resources saying, are you going to hear it again? And so the model, I believe they are here to testify if they would like quickly, but I'd like to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like.
Any questions from members on the amendment? Rep. Hansen has moved the A1 to get the bill in the form he wants. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? No. Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, I believe you have an oral amendment.
I have an oral amendment, but I left my sheet up there with the chair, so I'd have Mr. Savory talk about the need for removing, I believe, three sections from the bill because of fiscal questions.
Mr. Savory, while I look for that piece of paper, could you explain that to us?
Certainly. Chair and members, I believe Chair Hansen is speaking of a concern of a fiscal nature. The bill, as amended, references several references to food handler licensing, and this amendment would, oral amendment, would remove those sections. So there would be no concern if the bill would be fiscal and would have to return to Ways and Means. So I'll turn it over, Mr. Chair, to Ms. Baumbach to describe the amendment.
Yes, and to be clear, so the movement is to delete sections 21, 22, and 23. These are the sections that deal with fees. Ms. Baumbach.
Chair members, the oral amendment would be page 11, delete section 21, page 12, delete section 22, and page 14, delete section 23.
And that is my oral amendment to get the bill in the shape I want.
All right, thank you, Ms. Mollenbeck. We'll give it a moment while everyone gets that oral amendment. Again, that is an oral amendment to delete sections 21, 22, and 23 to get the bill in the form the author desires. Any questions from members on that oral argument before you vote on amending? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill came from the department. Could somebody come up and tell us if that's a crucial part to the bill or if it's really not needed and we're just dropping it because of time?
Thank you, Chair. We do have a member from
and Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, as she's coming forward, our intent would be that, you know, if it's been introduced and heard, that we could pull that up, those sections up in a fiscal bill, if we move a fiscal bill. But
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I appreciate hearing that from Chair Hansen. If we find there's a different way to move this, we would appreciate that. So that's fine if we need to move it to a fiscal bill.
Thank you. Chair Anderson, any follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. It's getting, you know, late in the session. Deadlines are fast approaching. And we just got the bill today. We have 7 minutes to discuss it. I don't know if I'm comfortable moving it out today until we hear, you know, what's in the bill and if it's significant, but let's get at it then. Yeah.
All right, then let's move to the vote for the oral amendment then, and then we'll get talking about the bill as fast as we can. All those in favor of the oral amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Oral amendment passes. Chair Hansen, your bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the Department of Agriculture's policy bill. It makes various changes across several agricultural chapters. Primarily, it starts out with definitions, a definition of agrivoltaic system relating to ag land preservation and conservation section, a definition of a cultivated variety and a cultivar in the noxious weed section, a definition of plant variety in the noxious weed chapter, a definition of propagate in the noxious weed chapter, a definition of propagating, amending a definition of propagating parts in the noxious weed chapter, definition of reasonable grounds in the noxious weed chapter, redefines specially regulated plants in the noxious weed chapter, redefines authority of county ag inspectors, entry of land, non-performance by inspectors, transportation and possession of noxious weed propagating parts, appeal of individual notice of permit revocation, unlawful acts, membership, compost, composting, plant amendment, plant biostimulant, soil amendment, compost and composting, application relating to food stands, that was in the fee section 21, 22, 23, deleted, reviser instructions with the noxious weed chapter and repealer. And the department is here to go answer any questions related to the bill. And the Department of Natural Resources is also here to answer any questions.
All right, if maybe representatives from those different departments want to make their way up in case there are questions. While they are doing that, I'll ask if anyone in the public would like to quickly testify on this bill before we move to member questions. Does it look like that? Let's move right to member questions. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Smith. So this would apply strictly to private property, or would this apply to state property as well?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is relates to, it would be the law, whether it's state, it doesn't differentiate between state and private property.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Smith. So would it in some way be like an unfunded mandate for a county weed inspector to now, in my township alone, tens of thousands of acres of DNR property that's overrun with buckthorn, wild parsnip? What is the both the authority and the duty of the local weed inspector to manage these tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres statewide?
Looks like a testifier came up, might help out with that question. When you're ready, identify yourself and then give the answer.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Anthony Cordelette, Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I oversee the seed, noxious weed, hemp, and biotechnology programs. So to the question, Representative, in terms of counties, there's a county agricultural inspector that is required in every county to oversee the weed law and the enforcement of it locally. And by election, township supervisors as well as city mayors also represent the weed law enforcement. That goes back over 100 years and has never been changed in the weed law. Yes, it is unfunded. Historically, the counties, townships, and cities have asked for local control, and that has never been changed. To your question, that is problematic. We help train the counties, townships, and cities at the department, but the funding is very low at the local level for, as you said, the amount of acres of noxious weeds that are in the state.
Representative Jacob, follow-up.
I guess my question then would be for the author, what's the plan to fund that? And is there a fiscal note to that, or how's that planned?
Chair Anderson.
Chair and Representative Jacob, this is a Department of Agriculture bill. There is no plan to be, no additional funding with this. This is a policy bill.
And Mr. Chair, members, and I know Representative Anderson worked on a bill last year that helped bring funding to the department, where we are currently able to give grants to the counties to receive money to do weed enforcement work. They can, obviously the money is given to the county entity once they apply, but they can also pass that down to the townships and cities that they work with. That's right now currently, other than the weed law does state that counties and townships have to provide money from their tax roll to manage noxious weeds.
Last follow-up.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative.
Just to say, extremely frustrating as a landowner who tries very hard to take care of their own property, to drive by tens of thousands of acres of state land that is overrun with buckthorn, wild parsnip, and to have the state look the other way on that while trying to somehow come after the private landowner, a tough pill to swallow.
Thank you. Representative Lawrence.
Vice Chair Smith, thank you very much. I got a couple questions, and I will start with number 14, section 14. You've changed the membership for this section and added the fact that members have to complete the application process with the Secretary of State. Fundamental question is, why do you feel this is necessary and the old process was not? Why the necessity for this specific change?
Chair Hansen. Testifier.
Sorry.
Yeah,
Mr.
No, go
Chair,
ahead.
Representative, the process has always been to go through the Secretary of State. The committee was formed in 2009, and for the last approximately 16 years or so, that's the way that the members have been going through. That is really to specify that you have to apply. So let me go back. 18.9.1 states that there are memberships required by certain entities. Sometimes those entities don't apply, and we can't force them to be on the committee, so those seats are vacant. So what we were trying to do with that language was specify that if you are listed on this membership requirement, that you have to reach out to the Secretary of State to apply.
Representative Lawrence and Chair Hansen, we are at time, unfortunately, and this room is getting. Would you like to lay this bill over to talk about it later? Would you like to?
Representative Hansen, should we lay it on the table?
Mr. Chair, I'd move to lay the bill over.
We are over time. Are we okay to lay over the bill, Chair Hansen?
Lay the bill over, yes.
All right, the bill is laid over, and with that, this meeting of the Agriculture Committee is over.